Today is Wednesday, June 16th, and you're listening to International Edition on The Voice of America. I am Chinua Adofo, broadcasting from Washington, D.C. Coming up, Presidents Biden and Putin begin summit in Geneva.
He'll urge Vladimir Putin to end election interference and cyber attacks, among other things.
Plus, UN Children's Fund say thousands of Tigray children face imminent death.
UNICEF is appealing to the Ethiopian government to live up to its promise of unimpeded access to conflict-ridden Tigray province.
Also, Somalia investigates suicide bombing that killed 10 army recruits. Our top story is in Geneva. Russian President Vladimir Putin thanked President Joe Biden and expressed wishes for a, quote, productive, unquote, meeting as the two kicked off their summit in Geneva. Putin told Biden upon first meeting him on Wednesday that he was thankful for the gathering as he knew the U.S. president, quote, had a long trip and lots of work, unquote. But the Russian president emphasized there are, quote, lots of questions accumulated in U.S.-Russian relations that require discussion at the highest level, unquote. The two are expected to address everything from cybercrime to Russia's alleged interference in the U.S. elections during their meeting. Biden, who has spoken to Putin over the phone, told the Russian leader that, quote, it is always better to meet face-to-face, unquote. Ahead of the meeting, armored vehicles and police patrolled the streets of Geneva as the city faced unprecedented heavy security. The world is focused on the outcome of the President Biden's talks with President Putin, but AP Washington correspondent Sagar Magani reports neither Washington nor Moscow hope for any meaningful progress in today's summit.
Relations are dismal, and the White House says rather than pushing for a wholesale reset like his recent predecessors, President Biden will instead look for small areas of potential cooperation. He'll urge Vladimir Putin to end election interference and cyber attacks, among other things. Putin's aim is to give the new administration his red lines to protect Moscow's interests.
That's AP Washington correspondent Sagar Magani. President Putin's top spokesman was tamping down expectations for the summit, saying the meeting might not produce major breakthroughs. Judy Walker with the AP has more.
Russian President Vladimir Putin's spokesman is cautioning that the leaders' talks today with President Joe Biden will not be easy or likely to yield any breakthroughs. Putin's spokesman Dmitry Peskov says the topics on the broad agenda are mostly problematic. Quote, we have many long-neglected questions that need to be trawled through. That's why President Putin is arriving with an attitude to frankly and constructively set questions and try to find solutions. He went on to say this day cannot become historic, and we shouldn't expect any breakthrough in Russian-American relations. Peskov says the bilateral issues to discuss include strategic stability, arms control, cooperation in regional conflicts and on the pandemic, and climate change. I'm Julie Walker.
The United States and European Union have reached a five-year truce in a long-running battle over EU subsidies to Airbus, the main rival to American aircraft manufacturer Boeing. The announcement of the deal came as President Joe Biden met European leaders in Brussels, from where VOA's White House Bureau Chief Steve Herman reports.
Trade truce signals U.S. President Joe Biden is taking the transatlantic relationship in a different direction from the presidency of Donald Trump, who escalated tariffs on America's trading partners and berated NATO members for not contributing enough to their mutual defense.
I have a very different view than my predecessor.
European Commission President Ursula von der Leyen told Biden that leaders here are grateful he is focusing on repairing the relationship early in his presidency.
And indeed, the last 4 years have not been easy.
In Geneva, Biden's final stop on his European trip, he is to meet with Russian President Vladimir Putin on Wednesday. Steve Herman, VOA News, Brussels.
President Joe Biden's administration on Tuesday unveiled a plan to address the threat of violence posed by white supremacists and militias after members of those groups took part in a deadly attack on the U.S. Capitol. In a speech on Tuesday, U.S. Attorney General Merrick Garland said coming days and months, he would convene an interagency task force dedicated to combating domestic terrorism. Garland said he had already, quote, begun to reinvigorate, quote, the task force. The White House released a 30-page plan for increased information sharing between federal and local officials and social media companies additional resources to identify and prosecute threats and new deterrents to prevent Americans from joining dangerous groups.
The national strategy is designed to coordinate and provide a principled path for the federal government's efforts to counter the heightened domestic terrorism threat using all available tools. Our current effort comes on the heels of another large and heinous attack, this time the January 6th assault on our nation's capital. We have now, as we have then, an enormous task ahead to move forward as a country, to punish the perpetrators, to do everything possible to prevent similar attacks, and to do so in a manner that affirms the values on which our justice system is founded and upon which our democracy depends. The resolve and dedication with which the Justice Department has approached the investigation of the January 6th attack reflects the seriousness with which we take this assault on a mainstay of our democratic system, the peaceful transfer of power. According to an unclassified summary of the March intelligence assessment, the two most lethal elements of the domestic violence extremist threat are racially or ethnically motivated violent extremists and militia violent extremists. In the FBI's view, the top domestic violent extremist threat comes from racially or ethnically motivated violent extremists, specifically those who advocated for the superiority of the white race.
That's U.S. Attorney General Merrick Garland. Israeli airstrikes hit the Gaza Strip on Wednesday in response to incendiary balloons launched from Palestinian territory. Gloria Tso of Reuters reports the strikes were the first since a ceasefire halted 11 days of cross-border fighting last month.
Israel launched airstrikes in Gaza on Wednesday in response to incendiary balloons from the Palestinian territory. This flare-up is a first test for Israel's new government after a tentative ceasefire stopped 11 days of cross-border fighting last month. The Israeli military said its aircraft attacked armed Hamas compounds in Gaza in response to their balloons, which the fire brigade reported caused 20 blazes in open fields and communities near the border. A Hamas spokesman confirming the Israeli attacks said Palestinians would continue to pursue their, quote, brave resistance and defend their rights and sacred sites in Jerusalem. Only hours before the strikes, there was an Israeli nationalist march in East Jerusalem that drew threats from Hamas, the ruling militant group in Gaza. Israel, which annexed East Jerusalem after a 1967 war, regards all of Jerusalem as its capital. However, Palestinians want East Jerusalem to be the capital of a future state that would include Gaza and the West Bank. Thousands of flag-waving Israelis congregated around the Damascus Gate in Jerusalem's Old City. Israel has recently beefed up its Iron Dome anti-missile system in anticipation of possible rocket attacks from Gaza. But as marchers began to disperse after nightfall, there was still no sign of rocket fire. An earlier march in May was diverted away from the Damascus Gate. However, that wasn't enough to discourage Hamas from firing rockets toward Jerusalem, an action that seemingly sparked last month's violence.
That's Gloria So of Reuters. Somali authorities are investigating an attack by a suicide bomber at the military training school that killed at least 15 recruits and wounded more than 20 others on Tuesday in the capital. The Al-Shabaab terror group claimed responsibility in a statement and has stepped up attacks ahead of elections expected by end of July. Mohamed Kahiye reports from Mogadishu.
The attack happened Tuesday outside General Dagabadan Military Training School south of the capital, Mogadishu. A suicide bomber who disguised himself as one of the recruits detonated his explosives as trainees were gathering for a security screening. Army Chief General Odawar Rage told the state media that 10 recruits lost their lives and 20 others were wounded and taken to various health facilities in the city. In a statement, militant group Al-Shabaab said that one of its fighters was responsible for the attack. The group said the attack happened inside heavily fortified Turkish-built military base. It put the casualty a total 40 dead and 50 wounded. This latest attack comes days after the army said an operation in the Middle Shabelle and Hiran regions killed 50 Al-Shabaab fighters. According to security expert Ahmed Hassan, the militants are responding to the increased pressure from the military.
So the attack would be in response to the ongoing military operation and to disrupt the stability of major cities designated to host the upcoming elections. A third intention could also be to discourage young citizens from joining the National Army. As you might be aware, we have recently observed an increase in high school graduates, in young men and women voluntarily subscribing to the army.
Somali security agencies, backed by their international partners, have beefed up the security across the country ahead of the presidential and parliamentary elections slated to take place in 2 months. Mohamed Kahi for VOA News in Mogadishu, Somalia.
When the leaders from the world's wealthiest nations met at the G7 summit in Cornwall, England, over the weekend, they announced a vaccine-sharing initiative that would see 1 billion shots spread across the world. Now it's up to aid and advocacy groups to overcome vaccine hesitancy. VOA's Arash Arabasadi has more.
Weekend, leaders have pledged over 1 billion doses.
That is the promise from the world's wealthiest countries to help some of the world's poorest countries combat COVID-19. The number falls well short of the 11 billion vaccine doses that Oxfam says is needed, calling the G7 summit a failure.
The G7 had a huge opportunity to actually deliver a global roadmap towards fully vaccinating the world. What we've seen is warm words and very little action.
Eloise Todd is co-founder of the Pandemic Action Network. She says numerous hurdles exist to get those billion doses into arms.
There's this kind of three prongs, really, to the vaccine strategy, which is procurement, buying the vaccines, delivery, getting them to a place where you can get them in people's arms, not only on the tarmac in the country, but do you have the healthcare workers, the community workers to be able to do that? And then, crucially, willingness to receive the vaccine.
Outreach programs to vaccinate communities in developing countries revolve around trusted endorsements from leaders, influencers, and health workers. Edwin Ikuoria is Africa Executive Director for the One Campaign. He says as more people get vaccinated, hesitancy will drop.
People become ambassadors because the fear is that if you take it, you will die. If you take it, you will be sterilized. If you take it, all kinds of things. So when people who have taken the vaccines also come out to talk about the benefits of how their life is going back to normal, how they are not afraid, how they are also living healthier and all of that, they become a part of the whole program of getting others who are not, to come on board.
The experts say success overcoming hesitancy in developing countries ultimately depends on having enough vaccines and enough people to administer them. Arash Arabasadi, VOA News.
An Indonesian town is rewarding elderly residents with live chickens, while Thailand is giving out cows for getting vaccinated for COVID-19 after the initial inoculation campaign saw a low turnout from the public. Libby Hogan of Reuters reports.
Governments the world over are offering incentives to encourage reluctant people to get vaccinated for COVID-19. Two towns in Southeast Asia are opting for livestock. In the Thai district of Mae Cham, 65-year-old Inkem Thong Kam rolled up his sleeves for the shot and won a weekly draw for live cattle.
This is the best gift ever from the district chief officer and the people who donated.
There are signs campaigns like this are working. In its second week of the Lucky Draw Prize, sign-ups for vaccines jumped 50%. Each cow is worth about $300, seemingly too good to resist. In Indonesia's Sipanas district in West Java, villagers can hear their rewards chirp nearby. Here, anyone who gets a shot gets a bird in exchange. 67-year-old Asap Sapudan said at first he was unsure about vaccine safety. Myths that the vaccine weren't halal also made him hesitate.
I was afraid that if I was vaccinated, I would die immediately. That was the main reason I was afraid. And I was also worried that this vaccine contained pork.
Officials in Sipanas say it's been a challenge to persuade older residents already afraid of the virus to get inoculated. Data shows only 5% of Indonesians have been vaccinated, less than half the target it's set for the end of this year.
That's Libby Hogan of Reuters. This is the Voice of America. The Chinese government says a nuclear power plant near Hong Kong had 5 broken fuel rods in a reactor, but no radioactivity leaked. This statement was the first official confirmation of the incident that prompted concern over the facility's safety. The environment minister says radiation rose inside number one reactor at the Taishan nuclear power plant, but was contained. The Hong Kong government said earlier it was watching the facility after its French co-owner reported increased, quote, noble gases, unquote, in the reactor. North Korean leader Kim Jong-un has warned about possible food shortages and urged the country to brace for extended COVID-19 restrictions. The North's official media said Kim also called for discussions on the, quote, current international situation, unquote, as he opened a major political conference. The report wasn't specific, but North Korea has been ignoring calls to resume nuclear negotiations with the United States that have stalled for 2 years. The standoff between the Indian government and Twitter has escalated after the country's technology minister accused the social media giant of not complying with local laws. Technology Minister Ravi Shankar Prasad said Twitter has chosen, quote, the path of deliberate defiance, unquote, when it comes to new internet regulations. Twitter said it was making effort to comply. The new rules require internet platforms such as Facebook and Twitter to raise content that authorities deem unlawful and to help with the police investigations, including identifying the originators of, quote, mischievous information, unquote. You are listening to International Edition on the Voice of America. I am Chinedu Ofo, broadcasting from Washington, D.C. The UN Children's Fund wants at least 33,000 severely malnourished children in northern Ethiopia's Tigray region face imminent death if they do not receive immediate help to treat their condition. Lisa Schlein reports for VOA from Geneva.
UNICEF is appealing to the Ethiopian government to live up to its promise of unimpeded access to conflict-ridden Tigray province. Agency spokesman James Elder warns this man-made disaster will have unimaginably tragic consequences for thousands of children if aid agencies are unable to reach them.
And incredulously, things can actually deteriorate further for children as food insecurity is expected to worsen over the coming months. So we risk many more deaths than the 33,000 that we fear if crops cannot be planted. So it's imperative that parties to the conflict ensure humanitarian actors, including UNICEF, have unimpeded and safe access on the ground to stave off widespread famine.
UNICEF reports at least 140,000 people in Tigray are facing famine-like conditions. Amid this crisis, it projects some 56,000 children will need treatment for severe acute malnutrition. This, it notes, is almost six times higher than the average annual caseload for the region. Elder says helping these children will be difficult. He says the warring parties have inflicted extensive damage to essential systems and services on which children depend for their survival. He says health facilities have been looted or damaged, and water infrastructure has been destroyed, causing safe drinking water to be in short supply. This, he warns, could lead to outbreaks of disease, putting malnourished children at even greater risk of dying. He says health workers have been attacked and harassed, discouraging many from returning to work.
Mobile health and nutrition teams need to be able to do their job safely. They're trying right now as we speak to do upcoming measles, polio, vitamin A and nutrition campaigns, remembering it's not just a lack of food that kills under fives, it's other diseases, water and sanitation.
UNICEF is calling for an immediate cessation of hostilities so children can safely receive the life-saving services they need to begin to rebuild their lives. It says it also needs the cash to be able to fund these services. The UN Children's Agency says it is $13 million short of the $47 million it needs to care for 1.3 million children, many of whom are struggling to survive. Lisa Schlein for VOA News, Geneva.
Arab League foreign ministers met Tuesday in Qatar, focusing on efforts to resolve the Nile River Dam conflict among Egypt, Sudan, and Ethiopia. Egypt's foreign minister says Cairo is seeking a diplomatic, not a military solution to its dispute with Ethiopia over the filling of the Renaissance Dam. Edward Uranian reports for VOA from Cairo.
بالنسبة للتحرك العربي في أزمة سد النهضة اليوم كان صدر قرار عن الاجتماع.
Arab League head Ahmed Abul Ghait and Qatar's foreign minister Mohammed bin Abdul Rahman bin Jassim Al Thani talked to journalists Tuesday after Arab League foreign ministers met in Doha. They said the group is calling on the UN Security Council to take up the water dispute between Egypt, Sudan, and Ethiopia. The league is trying to prevent a conflict when Ethiopia begins to fill the Grand Renaissance Dam again next month, despite the absence of a water use agreement with Egypt and Sudan. Mediation efforts by the African Union have not made any tangible progress, and both Egypt and Sudan have expressed concern that their national security will be adversely affected if Ethiopia proceeds with filling the dam. Egyptian Foreign Minister Sama Shoukry told Arab media Monday that Cairo is still trying to exhaust all diplomatic channels with Ethiopia before resorting to other means. He says Egypt is trying to reach a solution within the current negotiating framework, but if it fails and there is damage or a threat to the lives of Egyptians or Sudanese, then both countries have a responsibility to defend and protect their people. Sudan's irrigation minister, Yasser Abbas, told a press conference Monday in Khartoum his country would approve the filling of the dam if Ethiopia enters into a binding agreement with both Sudan and Egypt. He says Sudan is ready to accept a step-by-step agreement with Ethiopia if it will sign an accord including everything that has been agreed upon until now, including a guarantee that negotiations will continue within a finite period of time. Ethiopian Prime Minister Abiy Ahmed, who repeatedly has insisted the filling of the dam will continue as scheduled at the start of July, said recently his country was not trying to use the dam to pressure its neighbors. He says the dam is a sign of Ethiopia's independence, and through it, we affirm that we have no behind-the-scenes colonialist project to use against our neighbors. He added that Ethiopia is a proud, independent country and will continue to be so forever. Egyptian political analyst Said Sadik tells VOA that Ethiopia's ruling party has been using the dam negotiations for internal political considerations, including uniting disparate ethnic factions within the country and rallying support for ahead of upcoming elections. Edward Uranian for VOA News, Cairo.
Both Ukraine and North Macedonia conceded late goals in their opening matches at the European Championship, and both lost because of them. The teams will next play each other on Thursday, knowing another loss might end their chances of advancement. Both teams also need to limit distractions caused by nationalistic issues. Ukraine's yellow and blue jersey for Euro 2020 enraged Russia because they featured an outline of the country's territory showing the Crimea Peninsula. The North Macedonian Soccer Federation has asked for action to be taken against Marko Antonovic after claiming the Australian striker made nationalistic comments to a player of Albanian descent. That's it for our show today. For more in-depth and breaking news 24 hours a day, please visit voanews.com. On behalf of our producer, Nadia Taha, and our managing editor, Kate Pound-Dawson, I am Chinedu Ofo in Washington. Thank you so much for listening and have a great evening.
Voice of America's news, talk, and music programs are now at the tip of your fingers. Find everything at www.voaafrica.com. Listen to VOA's program lineup live anytime, day or night. Pick out your favorite shows and listen anytime you want. Download our podcasts, Check VOA Mobile from your cell phone. Subscribe to